So we've been looking a little at the Bardo Chodol, particularly this week. We've been looking at the visions of the Buddhas in the Bardo of Dharmata, the Bardo of reality. We've been trying to open up just a little bit to their symbolism. And today, in the final talk in the whole series, I want first of all to return to the beginning of the Bardo Chodol. We mustn't forget, as if we could forget, that the Bardo Chodol means the great liberation through hearing in the intermediate state between death and rebirth. It's a guide for the dead. At the time of death, a spiritual friend, a close spiritual friend, either your teacher, a lama, or a close brother in the Dharma, will read the text to you. So the Bardo Chodol, in that sense, is an expression of spiritual friendship, an expression of love and care for the dying. We all know what an extraordinarily difficult time that is for everyone involved, the time of death. It's a time we would rather not consider, but Buddhism goes to that place boldly, lovingly. Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, goes there boldly, lovingly. Karma Lingpa and the Nyingma tradition goes there boldly, lovingly. It's a difficult, painful, frightening time, but a time, precisely because of that, that is rich in possibility and potential. So now I want you to listen to the words of the Bardo Chodol. And these words are said ideally, just as respiration is about to cease, and for a period after that. So listen. O child of Buddha nature, the time has now come for you to seek a path. As soon as your respiration ceases, the luminosity known as the inner radiance of the first Bardo will arise. Immediately your respiration ceases, all phenomena become empty and utterly naked like space. At the same time, a naked awareness will arise, not extraneous to yourself, but radiant, empty, and without horizon or centre. At that moment, you should personally recognise this intrinsic nature and rest in that state. I too will introduce it to you. O Venerable One, I beg you not to be distracted from the cultivation of bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment for all beings. O child of Buddha nature, that which is called death has now arrived. Therefore you should awaken bodhicitta and concentrate your thought like this. I have arrived at the time of death. I will single-mindedly cultivate bodhicitta. I will meditate on loving-kindness, compassion, and an altruistic intention to attain enlightenment. For the benefit of all beings who are limitless as space, I must attain perfect Buddhahood. And in particular, you should think, at this moment, for the sake of all sentient beings, I must recognize the time of death as the arising of inner radiance, the Dharmakaya, the Buddha body of reality, and thereby act for the good of all sentient beings who are as limitless as space. Then the Lama, the spiritual friend, describes this for you so that you may recognize it clearly. O child of Buddha nature, listen. Pure inner radiance, reality itself, is now arising before you. Recognize it, O child of Buddha nature, this radiant essence that is now your conscious awareness is a brilliant emptiness. It is beyond substance, beyond characteristics, and beyond colour. Completely empty of inherent existence in any respect whatsoever. This is the female Buddha Samantabhadri, the essential nature of reality. The essence of your own conscious awareness is emptiness. Yet this is not a vacuous or nihilistic emptiness. This, your very own conscious awareness, is unimpededly radiant, brilliant and vibrant. This is the male Buddha, Samantabhadra. This is the Dharmakaya, the Buddha body of reality. This intrinsic awareness manifest in a great mass of light in which radiance and emptiness are indivisible is the Buddha nature of unchanging light. Just to recognize this is enough. If you recognize this brilliant essence of your own conscious awareness to be the Buddha, then to gaze into intrinsic awareness is to abide in the enlightened intention, the bodhicitta, of all the Buddhas. So this is what the spiritual friend reads to you, urging you to recognize this brilliant, luminous emptiness, this brilliant light without center, without horizon, without self and other. He points out that this is reality itself. This is the Buddha Samantabhadra, the all good, the all beneficent. And it's clear from the text that in order to recognize this, you need to summon up, contact, connect with bodhicitta, the desire, the will, the intention to gain enlightenment for all beings. You need to contact love and compassion. For this empty, all-pervading radiance is in fact bodhicitta in its profoundest, highest, deepest nature. Emptiness, radiant, glorious, with all-pervading energy, which is love and compassion. If you've trained in this deeply, you can recognize at death this true nature of things. Recognize it as your intrinsic awareness. Recognize it as the true nature of all things. So the text is making it very, very clear that training, practicing, living a life of bodhicitta, the intention to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all, is absolutely fundamental. Throughout the Bardo Todol, in fact, you're urged repeatedly to go forward. To go forward. That's what they say. Whatever is happening, the Lama says, go forward. Go forward with bodhicitta. Go forward with the intention to gain enlightenment for all. Go forward with faith, with confidence. Go forward with mindfulness. Go forward with loving kindness and friendliness. Whatever arises, go forward with that. If we haven't been able to recognize the luminosity as our deepest nature, we swoon, we fall away, we're utterly overwhelmed by the loss of ground. And we come to in a mind-made body, like the body we have in a dream. And the luminosity comes again, brilliantly, and now with sounds like 1,000 peals of thunder. And again, the Lama urges you to go forward, to go for refuge to the three jewels, to go to the Buddha for refuge. You can attain enlightenment. To go to the Dharma for refuge. You can follow a path. To go to the Sangha for refuge. There are friends, there are companions, there are guides you can be in relationship to. Go forward into this. Recognize all this as enlightenment, as your deepest nature. If we fail to do this, we swoon again, and we come to again. And in the first day, in the Bardo of Dharmata, the Bardo of reality, which is where we've been these last days. But we haven't yet, during this second week of the retreat, seen what happens on that first day. What happens is this. The whole of space will arise as a deep, rich, blue light. At that time, from the central Buddha field called pervasive seminal point, also known as the highest, and dense array, the transcendent Lord Vairochana, the illuminator, will dawn before you. His body, a brilliant, dazzling white, like sun shining on snow, fresh snow. He holds an 8-spoked golden wheel, and he embraces his consort, Arkasha Dartishvari, the lady of the realm of space. He's seated, Vairochana, on a magnificent throne of lions, and from his heart a ray of blue luminosity, radiant and clear, bright and dazzling, which is the natural purity of your consciousness, will emanate. It will shine piercingly, this brilliant blue light, towards your heart, and it's unbearably bright. At the same time, a dull white light shines from the realm of the gods, from the heavens, and under the sway of your deep delusion, you will be impelled towards it. And the Lama urges you not to do that if you follow the dull, inviting, cozy white light. You will be reborn in the realm of the gods, which, although happy, although blissful, is not enlightenment, is not lasting, but which will lead in the end to suffering and pain and dissatisfaction. So follow the luminous blue path. Recognize it as wisdom. Recognize it as the Dharma Dhatu Jnana, the wisdom of the all-pervading expanse of reality, the wisdom which is the whole of space. Take hold of the blue light, respond to the blue light, have confidence in the blue light. If you follow it, you will be liberated. You will gain enlightenment in the heart of Vairochana, the illuminator. Once again, as we've seen in previous talks, when the space of Bardo opens up, when the ground dissolves, two possibilities open. In this case, on the one hand, there is the wisdom of the all-pervading expanse of reality. This is the wisdom that has let go into the vastness. That's the complete letting go, the wisdom that arises from the complete letting go of any vestige, any final vestige, any clinging cloud, if you like, of self-view, of egotism. Everything that holds everything together has gone, and there is this serene letting go into this vast space. On the other hand, there is the dull white light of deep delusion, which leads to the realm of the gods, and this deep delusion arises because we've identified with some of the space, in fact, actually a tiny portion of it, although that seems pretty big to us. And that's very pleasurable. That expansion of ordinary consciousness is very pleasurable indeed. It's good to get away from the confines of ordinary consciousness for a while. And this opening up, this expansion, can happen in meditation. You can have those very pleasurable, very satisfying experiences as consciousness expands. And that's a very good thing. If they go on for a long time, and if we're a bit charismatic, we might even find ourselves getting a bit of a following. And this can be very dangerous. We can think that we've arrived at the vastness, at the wisdom of the Dharma Dhatu, the wisdom of reality's expanse. But we've just had some good experiences that have been pleasurable, and we've generalized from them. We've incorporated them into our self-definition. You're in deep delusion, because the whole show will sooner or later come to an end. The devas, the gods, suffer very greatly, as we saw last week in the talks last week. In the tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, the gods occupy these very long lives, as it were, and they're just blissed out in these long lives. It's a good time state, and they're hanging out with their god friends. But they have this kind of slow, painful ending. Apparently one of the great tragedies in existence is the ending of a god. Apparently what happens is, in the god realms, first of all, the complexion starts to fade. You know, the lovely glowing complexion of the god just starts to fade. And they start to smell bad. The perfume starts to fade away and they start to pong a bit. Their garlands, beautiful garlands that they wear, start to fade. And the god friends just vanish. All the kind of godlings that are around, they leave. You're not cool anymore. And then you see, there you are on your own, everything kind of fading out, and you have a look at your next birth, and it looks really horrible compared to your present state, to what you've known. So we don't want that to happen, do we? Probably none of us will end up as gurus with a following, although you never know, it does happen with the most unlikely and most unpromising material. but there's something else. There's something else that we need to consider when looking at the response to the dull white light that shines from the gods. I've spoken of it as getting some pleasure out of the expansion of consciousness, out of that little bit of spaciousness that you get, and thinking that this is it. This is it. I'm in the space. I'm in the wisdom of the Dharma Dhatu, but you've just got a bit of spaciousness going on. So what's this about? It raises the whole issue, I think, of having experiences, of having powerful experiences, of having strong experiences. And you talk to some people sometimes as if their life is dedicated to having experiences, strong experiences, weird experiences, altered state experiences. They even think that the spiritual life is about having strong, weird, altered state, spaced out experiences. It's about having trips, of whether or not induced by drugs, catharses and all the rest of it. That's being a spiritual person. And we have to face it that our modern society seems to be utterly addicted to having powerful, strong, weird experiences in all sorts of spheres. And when we take that attitude, we form that attitude to what we think, to what we conceive as the spiritual life. So we go on the search for experience. We go around the different spiritual groups and the different teachers and maybe drugs and raves and clubbing if we're younger. If the old fogies like me won't be doing that, but anyway. And maybe a bit of Buddhism thrown in. The important thing is to have the experience. There's no discrimination, there's no evaluation, there's no discernment regarding the quality of it all, of the status of it all. It's all mixed up, religion, psychology, communication skills, yoga, exercise, diet, parties, sex, tantric sex, everything for experience. And you think of yourself as a spiritual person, really into growth and expansion. I mean, it's everywhere in our society, it's all pervasive. You know, Madonna. Goodness, going on about the Kabbalah. David Beckham, you know, with Kabbalah strings. Can you believe it? It's, you know, it becomes a kind of fashion accessory. Spiritual techniques as fashion statement. And of course, it's just another kind of conformity. And so unbelievably lightweight. You know, we do these things we call spiritual, religious growth. And we're just confirming our worldliness. It's so utterly conformist, it's so straight, forgive the expression. Buddhism, we have to remember, is actually a critique of the world, a critique. That's what the Dharma is. Nirvana is a critique of being in the world. Nirvana isn't even an experience. There's no word for experience in Buddhist texts. Nirvana isn't an experience. Nirvana is cessation. The experience to end all experiences, which, don't get me wrong, it's not a nihilistic void or anything like that, but it's the ending of all this stuff. These days, you know, if I'm on trains and buses and things like that, I hardly dare say to people that I'm a Buddhist. I've had so many strange conversations, and people, you know, you get into this thing and you end up in this really kind of lightweight, flaky kind of world, lacking in any rigour. You know, I wish I could say, well, I'm a brain surgeon, actually, or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Now, I know I'm sounding rather drastic and extreme, and perhaps I'm even sending myself up. I don't want to sound like the sort of you know, the Daily Telegraph of Buddhism, you know, Daily Telegraph leader or something like that. So I am pushing this out to make the point. I'm sure none of you are at the extreme I'm talking about. Yeah, pretty sure. But maybe you can identify with it just a little bit, just to some extent, because perhaps it's inevitable in this day and age for all of us to different degrees. And maybe it's a kind of phase that's sort of necessary, part, if you like, of the journey, part of the journey in trying to sort of sort out, you know, what we're doing with ourselves, a phase that hopefully will grow beyond as we grow out of. As we move into a more rigorous, serious spiritual training, there comes a point when we need to seriously evaluate experiences. We need to assay them. I love this word, assay. It's what a jeweller does with a priceless jewel. He assays it to see its precise value. We need to assay our experiences. What is the actual quality of this? What is its meaning? What is its direction? Apart from getting a bang off of it, what does it really mean? What does it amount to? Perhaps another way of looking at this is in terms of the search for ecstasy, the search for the ecstatic. The big experience, however induced, is surely a search to stand outside of ourselves. Ecstasy comes from the root ekstasis, standing outside of yourself. There's, I think, a great longing to lose ourselves because the self is felt as an oppression, a burden. So we want to lose ourselves in the drug, the dance, the rave, in sex, in a group, in the big experience, whatever. Even on a very day-to-day level, to relieve the tedium, the dullness, switch on the TV, anything but to experience that dullness. Buddhism doesn't reject the desire for the ecstatic, not at all. Ecstasy is incredibly important, but it could be quoted out of context. I just realised. Padmavajra says ecstasy is incredibly important. Appearing in a newspaper, Buddhist teacher says ecstasy is important. Yeah, but I'm not talking about the drug, all right? So we don't reject the desire for ecstasy. But it would say that most of the ways that we're going about it will not bring a lasting ecstasy, a lasting release from the burden of selfhood. There are other ways, effective ways, of inducing ecstasy that actually aren't, and in fact most ways we try to induce it, we're not really doing it. We're just intensifying a certain aspect of the self, a certain feeling, a certain mood. In any case, you could say, you know, sort of a deva really is just an extended mood. A heavenly state is just an extended mood. You've just excluded aspects of experience. In any case, if you're dependent on those sources of ecstasy, what are you going to do when there isn't a body to put the stuff in anymore? This is a very famous Tibetan Lama was once asked in the 60s, you know, at the height of psychedelia when, you know, people were going and getting teachings from Tibetan masters and, you know, but, you know, thinking that taking LSD and all the rest of it was part of the path. They asked him the question, well, what do you think of LSD as the path? I mean, people really did ask those questions in those days. Perhaps they still do. And his reply was very cryptic. Well, what are you going to do when you haven't got a body to put the drug in anymore? Which I think really kind of answers it very well. What are you going to do in the bardo? What are you going to do when you're just with yourself, as it were? But ecstasy is important. Pleasure is important. The pleasure that comes with expansion of self, of consciousness, is very important indeed. It is actually like food and drink. The spiritual life can't be, mustn't be, a dour and dull and miserable affair. I mean, if it's like that, you're just going to react and you're just going to want to get off somehow. So we need to think of approaching the issue of ecstasy in other ways. We need an approach to ecstasy that relates to Vairochana's Dharmadhatu wisdom, the wisdom of reality's expanse. We need an ecstasy that comes from actually connecting with reality. First of all, in a very ordinary way, collecting with the whole of reality. And one example of this is when we do the metta bhavana. When we develop metta, when we genuinely abide in loving kindness, when that happens, when it really happens, we enter an ecstatic state. We're outside of ourselves. When you really get absorbed in the metta bhavana, you stand for a time outside of the boundaries of yourself. Our self, our consciousness has softened, it's become transparent. And of course this arises, it comes through giving our attention, our loving attention to others. When you're fully absorbed in that, in a relaxed and natural way, fully absorbed in the welfare of others, not just one other person, but a whole range of people, a whole range of beings. When you're doing that without any desire or craving or expectation of reward, you start feeling ecstatic. And that's nearer to the real, the true ecstasy. And it can become, if we practice, deep and lasting. Not that we crave it, not that we're trying to get it, although, you know, if you're into ecstasy, I'd recommend the metta bhavana. If you really are addicted to ecstasy, do the metta bhavana regularly. I mean, you have great ecstasies with it. Not that we crave it, not that we try to get it. If you're trying to get it, it won't happen. You don't try to have and possess the experience. No, your concern is with loving well. In loving without clinging and attachment. Loving through seeing clearly. Seeing others as they are in themselves. Not just on the meditation cushion, but in our life, in our communication with others, in our work. And loving broadly in consistency. If we have that orientation, the ecstasies arise. They come naturally. You don't make them happen. They arise. They come like leaves to a tree when you least expect it. We have evaluated, we've assessed, we've assayed experience. And we've determined that it's not about having big, weird, strong experiences. They can be such a massive distraction. You meet people sometimes and they've had a big experience and they just keep talking about it. Of course, that happened long, long ago. And it's just become another form of attachment. So we've seen that it's not about having big experiences. It's about loving well, in this case. Loving wisely. Loving clearly. Loving broadly. That's the issue. So talking like this, talking about evaluation, raises another issue. The issue of hierarchy. Not a very popular topic in our highly egalitarian age. By hierarchy, I don't mean social hierarchy. I don't mean political hierarchy. I don't mean religious hierarchy. I don't mean power hierarchy. I'm not even really talking about a hierarchy of people at all. I'm talking about hierarchy of consciousness, hierarchy of being. In this sense, the Dharma is profoundly hierarchical. Certain states of consciousness, Buddhism would say, the Dharma would say, are better, more valuable, more meaningful than others. The Dharma is in fact nothing less than a sequence, an unfolding sequence of these states of consciousness. And we need to learn in our practice how to discern what really conduces to the attainment of these states and what doesn't. This is actually the message of the Bardo Tadol. The brilliant white light of Vairochana is better than the dull white light of the gods. It's more brilliant, it's more beautiful, it's brilliant, it's beautiful, it's authentic, it's real, it's quality, it's value, whereas the light of the gods is dull, insipid and pale, a kind of simulacrum. Now, there's a lot of discomfort around the notion of hierarchy, even this notion of spiritual hierarchy, in the West in particular, which in some ways I think is a bit strange because it's not as if we've had recent history of serious political suppression. It's interesting in India, living as I have done with the so-called ex-untouchable Buddhists, the Buddhist community who converted from the lowest strata of the Indian caste system. They have no problem at all with spiritual hierarchy, the notion that there are higher spiritual states to attain to. And these are people with backgrounds of severe repressive social, political and religious structures. And it's interesting, the response to genuine spiritual hierarchy, to values they can live by and body, rise to, are in fact, they see as the way to throw off repressive social structure. In the West, there can be discomfort with the notion of hierarchy because, well, I wonder, because maybe it could be the very idea of spiritual growth and spiritual development just sort of attacks, as it were, our individualism, our self-centeredness. I think I've lost a page. So I'll have to improvise. This is good. This is a Bardo moment. Yes, so could it be that that's what's happened? This is great. I'm so pleased that this is happening. And I'm blushing and I'm going really hot because I prepare these things, you know, and I think, you know, I'll say that and I'll say that. And it's a, you know, in a way I'm making myself safe. And I think it's really brilliant. I think the Buddhas have done something. I think Padmasambhava has done something. I think they just slipped a page out saying, right, you know, we're not going to make it neat and tidy for you. And right, so I'm going to react now. I'm in that, the ground's gone. Where was I? Go forward. Thank you, Lamaji. Yeah. I'm speechless. So in the West, I think there can be this discomfort can come up when you talk about hierarchy but I think maybe it could be to do with it attacks this sort of individualism, the individualism that's developed in the West. It's really interesting, this. We are, after all, profoundly democratic and egalitarian people, beings. And I'm very thankful in many ways that we live in a democratic and egalitarian society. It's given us a great deal of freedom. I don't know what I'd be doing without it. I don't want to live in a feudal society. But in terms of spiritual growth and spiritual development, I know very well that we have to address the issue of what you might call the democratization of consciousness. It's not just that democracy and egalitarianism are a sort of social and political arrangement, however good that might be. We are profoundly democratic beings, profoundly egalitarian beings, that it's become the way we look at consciousness. Our consciousness is democratized. But in Buddhist terms, a democratic consciousness cannot grow and develop. You need a notion of hierarchy in order to develop. And I know very well that the democratization of consciousness, of mind, of heart, is deeply unhelpful to me. If I give every mood, every whim, every fancy, every feeling, every thought an equal say, an equal vote, I'm finished. I'm going to be torn apart by the contradictions because they're all so incredibly, unbearably contradictory. So we actually need to introduce into our minds a king of the mind. Not any old king, not a tyrant, not a dictator who imposes a violent order on our lives. As Wallace Stevens says, this American poet I'm very fond of, in one of his aphorisms, a violent order is a disorder. A violent order is a disorder. The fascist and the totalitarian system is already utterly dysfunctional, even if the trains do run on time. So we can swing in our lives between a mind that is just incredibly loose, where we kind of follow every whim and fancy, But we can also sometimes try and introduce that sort of tyrant into the mind, you know, that makes us act in a certain way. We just get tight and rigid. We can swing between, if you like, a democratized consciousness and an authoritarian consciousness. So we need a king. But we need a true king, a rightful king, a natural king, a just and true king, a benign and glorious king who blesses, pacifies and transforms. That draws forth every aspect of our being and of our life. That draws it towards the highest, the best, the deepest purpose. Now this king of the mind, of our minds, cannot be imposed from without. This king has to be found in ourselves and by ourselves. Nobody can come along and say, this is the king, and you have to follow him or it. We have to find this king within ourselves, by ourselves. We need to turn and face ourselves and find and assent to this king of the mind. This is the king that we need to find if we're to transform the chaos into cosmos. If we're to transform the wheel of life into the mandala, the sacred circle of the Buddhas. We need to find the king who is a refuge. And by refuge we mean something upon which you can rely, who won't let us down, who we can turn to, who we can invoke when life is falling apart in those times of crisis and danger. We need the king who we can serve, the king who can give life, meaning and purpose. And again, I want to stress that only we ourselves can find this king. Put it another way, we need to find the master. We need to find the master current of our being. The imagery of the king is found throughout the Dharma, and it's found in the image of the Buddha Vairochana. Remember, he it is who appears on the first day. Vairochana, perhaps you could say, is the Rajadi Raja in the Bardo Tadol, the king of kings, because he is the Buddha of the centre. All the Buddhas are kings because all the different Buddhas appear with a retinue in mandalas. But here, Vairochana is at the centre. He occupies the pure land known as Akanishta, the highest, and his name means the illuminator, which is an ancient Indian name for the sun. In Japan, Vairochana was called the Great Sun Buddha. He's pure white, dazzling white. White is the colour in which all the others are contained and brought together. And he turns the wheel, which is the Dharma Chakra, the wheel of the Dharma, the eight-spoke wheel. Again, this is comes from the symbolism, the ancient Indian symbolism of royalty. The Chakravarti in ancient Indian tradition, the wheel-turning monarch, is the just and true king. And it's the symbol of the Buddha's teaching. We have a Dharma Chakra there. And the Buddha's first teaching is called the setting in motion, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. So it's the implications there that the Buddha is the king of the spiritual world. Vairochana is seated on a throne of lions. The lions are, of course, the king of the beasts. And the Buddha's teaching is likened to a lion's roar. In the same way, when the Buddha speaks the truth, that's followed by silence as we take it in. In the same way that the lion roars in the jungle, all the other beasts keep silent. Vairochana's time is all times, all space, all seasons, all moods, all rasas. And his wisdom is the Dharma Dhatu Jnana, the wisdom of reality's expanse, the wisdom of all-pervading reality. It contains all the other wisdoms. It brings them into one. Chogyam Trungpa, a very eminent Tibetan Lama, very active in the West, speaks of this as panoramic awareness. I rather like that. Panoramic awareness, the awareness that takes in everything. So Vairochana appears on the first day of the Bardo of Dharmatar. He has no retinue. He doesn't need it. He occupies all of space, just space. But on the sixth day, Vairochana comes again. And he comes at the centre with the other Buddhas all around, the four other Buddhas that we've been talking about. They come with their retinues and other deities. Varochana comes at the centre with the mandala of the five Buddhas. Magnificent, it's a magnificent, overwhelming display. Lights, brilliant lights are pouring forth. Reality is pouring forth in a crescendo. And again, the Lama urges you not to pull back. Recognize this all as being your own heart. This display is your heart. It's not outside of you. It's all in you. It's the four directions and the center of your heart displaying itself. They're all emanating from you. It's you. It's your deepest nature. Recognize it. Do not be afraid. Do not shy away to the dull lights of the six realms. Have courage. Rely on the five Buddhas. Rely on the kings of the mind. Rely on the kings of the heart of the mandala. All the dazzling, overwhelming brilliance is what you really are. So don't follow the pallid, dull, comforting lights of deep delusion and envy and hatred and craving and ignorance and pride. That's a ghastly simulacrum, a distortion of the deepest nature of all existence. So, we need to recognize the wise and glorious king. This phrase, the wise and glorious king, which for some reason I find particularly appealing, is another name for the primordial Buddha Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra is depicted as completely naked. He's a naked Buddha, deep blue in colour, of the depth, the deep blue of the depth of space, just seated in meditation. And you might remember way back at the beginning of this talk, I mentioned Samantabhadra in the context of the bardo of the moment of death. And then the Bardo Tathagata tells us when we die, all phenomena become empty and utterly naked like space, radiant, empty and without horizon. This is not a vacuous or nihilistic emptiness, but this is your very own awareness, unimpededly radiant, brilliant and vibrant. This is Samantabhadra, whose name means the all-beneficent. He is the deepest, or highest, if you prefer, essential nature, emptiness, voidness, selflessness, that shines, radiates splendidly, that shines with wisdom. That is the energy of all-pervading loving kindness. This Samantabhadra is the wise and glorious king. This is Bodhicitta, the heart of the enlightened or awakened mind. This is also actually the space, the vastness in which all the visions arise and cease. This is the natural king of the mind, the natural king of the heart. And it's this that we can turn to, that can guide us in the bardos of life, of dream, of meditation, of death, of the intermediate state, and of taking birth. In times of crisis and breakdown, when the ground goes, mini crises, major crises, we can turn to Bodhicitta. We can recognize that yes, this happens. Things break down. They're insubstantial. They're empty. We can serenely accept that truth. And we can see it with the light of understanding, of awareness. That's the beginning of wisdom. And we can relate to it all with the energy of friendliness and love and kindness. Whatever happens, whoever happens, whatever they might do to us, we can relate to them in this way. This is what you can rely on. These three things won't let you down. These are the refuge. The Buddha is the ultimate nature of things. The Dharma is the means to see it. The Sangha are the lovers, the brothers, the friends, the sisters that live for this, that live from this. So we cannot wait for the bardos to happen, the breakdowns, the changes, the loss of ground. We cannot just wait for death and hope that we can muddle through these things. We have to act now. We have to live now. We have to practice now. We have to train now. We have to discover for ourselves the wise and glorious King, whatever he looks like, so that he enriches our lives and other people's with his beneficence. Then, when the bardos happen, whatever bardo happens, we will have everything we need.